Good morning. Well, we're rapidly coming upon that season of the year when we once again think about what Jesus Christ did for our salvation, where again we think about the commitment we made at the time that we were baptized. You know, it has been said that the Passover season, during that season, when we take the bread and when we take the wine, that we are, in a sense, renewing our baptismal commitment. And certainly I believe that is correct. We are at least reconfirming or reaffirming the commitment that we made back at the time, the commitment that was sealed, that we made and then was sealed in baptism. And most of us, I think, reflect on our own baptisms at that time of the year. We think back at the time when we made that commitment initially, and we went down into the watery grave, and we came up intending on doing everything right. I remember the first week after my baptism, I was sorely disappointed that I didn't continue in the righteousness that I thought and intended to continue in. You know, you find all kinds of little things in your life that kind of jump out at you. You start to realize more and more things along the way. You still have some of those old tendencies. And in fact, going back even before that, many years ago, this is well over 30 years ago now, I'd been reading the material. You know, when I was an infant, they took me down to the altar and the minister took me in his arms and put a little water on my head. And then some people call that baptism. Later on, I would learn that baptism, biblical baptism, was by immersion. So I'd come to the place in my life after reading some material and comparing with the Bible that I believed that baptism properly was by immersion. And I believed that a person had to come to repentance first, that infant baptism was a false practice. So what did I do? In those days, you know, it was kind of hard to find the kind of church I was looking for. I didn't think the Church of God, the worldwide Church of God in those days, I didn't realize there was a meeting within 30 miles of my home, because they didn't advertise it in those days. So I went down to Terrapin Creek, where we went to swim and sometimes bathe, and I baptized myself. More or less like some of you may remember the movie The Apostle. Remember how he went out in the water and he baptized himself, and I think he laid hands on himself, didn't he? And he proclaimed himself an apostle. Well, I don't think I laid hands on myself, but I did go down into the waters, you know, because I knew immersion was correct. And so I baptized myself. Only later I realized that I came to believe that was still not the proper way. And I was glad because, you know, I still messed everything up. And so I was glad I got to take another shot at it. Took another shot at it, and still, I found I still had those same flaws in my life afterward. And they don't always just come out automatically. You have to work on them for a long time sometimes. So I think we can all relate to that. In fact, I'm not the only one. I even know one person who went down into the waters of baptism, came up all clean, you know, as the minister said, you know, you're clean, you're cleansed from your sins and so on. And as she was walking out of the pool, or actually I think it was a lake or something, before she got out, she slipped and fell, hurt her knee, and the first word out of her mouth after going down into the cleansing waters of baptism was one of those words. I won't say it here. One of those words. And not only was it before God, which is the most important thing, it was in front of those elders and that big crowd of people that were gathered around there. And, you know, before she even got out of the water, Dunn went back to cussing again. So that kind of thing does happen. Of course, in this case, people, they just laughed about it because they knew it was just an old habit. It didn't mean anything. Didn't mean that the person was not converted. Didn't mean that the baptism was no good, that the person did not receive the Holy Spirit with the laying on of hands and so on. But in any case, this is a time of year, coming up on the time of year, when we will again begin thinking about those things and thinking about what Jesus Christ did in his self-sacrifice. I oftentimes wonder about the sacrifice of Christ. I have many times over the years wondered, what is it about his self-offering that pleases God? And we think of it in terms of a sacrifice for sins. It has been said that his life is worth more than the sum total of all other human beings combined. And that by his laying down his life, by his sacrifice, God's wrath against us, if we accept him, was appeased. And I've wondered how that works. And, you know, I don't really think any of us know all the details of the atoning sacrifice of Christ. I don't think any of us know the mind of God to the point that we can lay out a full picture. As Paul says, we see in part, our knowledge is in part. The time will come when our knowledge will be full. All I can say at this time is that I do not believe that God looked down and saw when his innocent son, his sinless son, was put to death under the hands of wicked men, that he looked down and said, now my wrath is appeased. Now I'm happy about that. That's great. Not in that sense. But what was it then? You wonder, what was it that God was pleased with in the death of his son? You know, if your son was put to death, was murdered by wicked men, your son was perfect, just a really good kid, as it were. And he was killed by ruthless people. You know, remember, these were the people Jesus said that they were snakes and vipers and sons of hell. And here they put him to death. They murdered him. And yet God somehow is pleased with this. You wonder how. Well, the only thing I can say about that is, I mean, I can say a lot about it. Someday I probably will. But one thing I can say for sure about it is God is not pleased with the activities of murderers. God is pleased with the obedience of his son. That's what was pleasing to God. He went all the way to death, obedient to him. And so therefore his sacrifice was a pure and holy sacrifice. And if not for his obedience, his absolute faithfulness, his total commitment to his heavenly Father, then the sacrifice was in vain. But because he was perfectly obedient even unto death, then his sacrifice is efficacious. And certainly we are thankful for it, because we see our own flaws and imperfections, and we have to rely on him and what he has provided for us. But as we approach this season, we realize when we come together and we take the bread and the wine on that evening, that what Jesus Christ did in giving his disciples the bread and the wine and saying, do this in remembrance of me, we realize that he was, on the one hand, instituting something brand new. It was new. From henceforth, it would be a commemoration of his death, of his self-offering. And yet, at the same time, even though this was in that sense brand new, it was rooted in something that was very old, very ancient. It was rooted in a sacrificial rite called the Passover. Go back with me to Exodus 12 for just a few moments. Exodus chapter 12, where we see the Passover instituted. I think we all know the story of how the children of Israel grew in great numbers while in Egypt. Their forefathers had gone to Egypt to escape famine in the land of promise, the land of Canaan. And once they were in the land of Egypt, they grew in numbers and became, were perceived of as a threat by a Pharaoh that did not know Moses. So they were eventually enslaved. And so they spent some 400 years or so in slavery in the land of Egypt. And the time came that God would deliver them from Egypt, just as he had promised from the very beginning that he would do. He had told them that he would give them the land that he had promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. When all, you know, if you had been there, probably after, if you were in that last generation, and you knew about it, you'd heard about the promises that God had given to your fathers before you, you would probably have come to the place where you'd begun to question them a little bit, said, well, what are we doing as slaves in Egypt? Why are we here when we should be there if God really promised this land to us? And furthermore, if we got out of here, how on earth would we inherit this land? There are people who live there. So there are all kinds of, you know, mental obstacles would come up in your mind, no doubt. And I'm sure many of these people who had heard the stories that had been passed down from all the way from the time of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob and the sons of Jacob through Joseph, of course, who was in Egypt, had been there when Jacob's sons arrived and brought their families with them. They no doubt had questioned some of this, but then the time came when God did send the promised deliverer. His name was Moses. You know the story. You see it year by year when they replay the Ten Commandments movie. It's all probably one of our old favorites. And of course, some remakes of the Ten Commandments, so some new versions of it have been appearing in recent years. And we have the original right here in the Scriptures. So we read it at this time of year, probably every year. It says here in chapter 12, verse 1, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, 'This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you.'" Why was this month, this particular month? And this was the month of the Exodus, of course. This is when God instituted the Passover sacrifice. Why would this month be the first month? It would be the first month because this is the month that God would bring them out of Egypt and bring them into the wilderness. And so by remembering God in the very first month of the year, this was an important part of Israel's retaining God in their knowledge. You see, God set things up in such a way so that His acts of redemption in history would coincide with the seasonal cycle, because that was their very livelihood, the seasonal cycle. They depended on it. Why were they in Egypt to begin with? I mentioned it already. It was because of a famine in the land. So they came to Egypt because they knew there was food there. You see, the ancient peoples, what we do today, they depended on a harvest. And when that harvest didn't come, or for us today, when it doesn't come, you know, I've heard people say jokingly, and I think it's partly serious, some people don't think of it very much because they grow up in cities and don't ever know anything about the farms. So, well, you know, if the farmer's having trouble, that's just too bad. I'll get my groceries down at the grocery store anyway. I guess the Israelites could have said, well, if there's a famine in the land, we don't have any grain or anything, that's okay because we have plenty of cattle. We'll go on the Atkins diet for a while. Well, of course, the cattle have to be fed too, but, you know, it's not thinking things through. The point is that if you didn't have a regular and full harvest, then life was going to be adversely affected. So the sons of Jacob made their way down to Egypt in order to escape a famine in their land, because down in Egypt, the Nile flowed over year after year, and it brought fertility to the land. Also, they had the elaborate irrigation system there, so they were all set. That's why Egypt was such an important, one of the reasons Egypt was such an important nation and so powerful in those days is because of its economic security, based upon the continuing. It didn't always continue. There were problems, for example, back in the days of Joseph. But they were seen as, the Egyptians were seen as having this great deal of security because of their successful agriculture. So people would come from other nations, go to Egypt when they experienced famines in their lands. But now God is saying, we're going to leave this place of security. Yeah, it's a good thing you're going to get out of slavery. But, you know, remember, you're also going to leave the security of having regular meals on the table, or at least having of knowing where they come from. Now we're going out into the wilderness, and we're going into the land where your fathers came from because of famine. A little bit scary when you're moving a whole nation of people like that, and they began to think about food. So here God says, this is the first month of the year for you. Now later we read that this month is the month of the Abib. We think of the name of the Hebrew month being the month of Abib. Actually, it's my understanding that in Hebrew the definite article appears there. It's the month of the Abib. Now what is the Abib? The Abib refers to a certain stage of the ripening of the barley harvest. When it reached that stage, that was called the Abib. So in the month in which the Abib, or this ripening, the stage of maturity was reached, it was that month that the barley harvest could begin. It was that month that God would bring the people out of Egypt. So you see how that God deliberately aligned His actions in history with the seasonal cycle, so that the seasonal cycle being interwoven with their very livelihood, their very existence, they would always remember Him in connection with the harvest. So He says, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It could have been another month. Other nations began their months at other times in the year. Our month begins, our first month of the year begins in the dead of winter. theirs began always in the spring, when the barley was in the abib, when it had reached a certain level or a certain stage of ripening and would soon be ready for gathering. And then at that point, the priest knew, when they were in the land of promise, that he would be able to offer the wave sheaf offering and so on, the first fruits offering. And so that was the beginning of the year because they were brought out of Egypt. And so their very livelihood, their gathering in of the harvest year after year, would be intimately connected with God's delivering them from Egyptian bondage. And also it would inspire thanksgiving for the harvest. For God goes on to give them. Once he brings them into the wilderness, he gives his commandments to them. He gives his law to them. He makes a covenant with them. You read about that in Exodus 20 through 23. And in chapter 24, you see the ratification, the affirmation of the covenant. And then later on, you begin to read about covenant promises and covenant curses. If you obey me, God says, then these blessings will overtake you. If you disobey me, I will remove these blessings and bring curses on you. Let's read about that over in Deuteronomy, book of Deuteronomy. Chapter 28, God says, "Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently," this is a sermon of Moses. He's talking about what God had previously revealed. He says, "Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God." So, keep in mind, this is connection with the covenant. This people, who above all other nations on the earth, and who was singled out because of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were singled out, and they were the ones who received the law. They're the ones with whom God made this covenant. So these are covenant blessings right here that we're reading about. He goes on to talk about how they'll be blessed in the city, they'll be blessed in the field, they'll be blessed when it comes to bearing children, their cattle and their flocks, their herds and so on will be blessed. So it'll be blessing. Blessings will overtake them. They're not going to have to worry about food as long as they're obedient to God, as long as they're faithful to the covenant to which they agreed. No worry about the harvest coming in. They will not have to rely. They will not have to go back to Egypt and rely on the overflowing of the Nile or the elaborate irrigation system or anything else man-made. They just do their work, they do their jobs, they obey God, and God will supply them with the blessings. That's what this is about. Verse 12 says, "The Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain in your land in its season, and to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow." This is not a prohibition against borrowing. It's just saying that you're going to be so wealthy as a nation, as a people. You're going to be so blessed that you won't need to borrow anything. You'll have so much you'll be able to lend to many other nations. That's what he's talking about here. And it's a wonderful thought to consider, especially if you've been in Egyptian bondage or you know the experience of your forefathers who have come through the wilderness and have had to face these trials in the wilderness, the difficulties along the way, wondering where the next meal was coming from. And now then, once you make that covenant, you're in the land, and you're securely in the land, and you know that you're obedient to the covenant, then you can rest assured that God is going to do his part. But then there's a warning associated with this. In verse 15, he says, "But it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you." And then he goes on to say that they would be cursed in the cities, they'd be cursed in their fields, they would not have the abundance of harvest, of crops that he had promised for obedience. They would not have any of the blessings. In fact, they would be driven out of the land. And they would stay out of the land until they repented. And then God would, through great difficulty for them, would bring them back. So it's a warning to stay faithful. But you wonder, why would someone go straying after other gods after having all these blessings promised? Why would these people disobey and turn away from the covenant? Well, go back over to Deuteronomy chapter 8. There's something here that perhaps sometimes we forget or we overlook. You know, there is a risk associated with wealth. A risk. There's nothing wrong with wealth. There's nothing wrong with a nation being wealthy. I want this country to be prosperous and wealthy. I want there to be jobs aplenty. I want there to be food in abundance. But there is a risk that goes with that. Let's read about it here. He says in verse 2, chapter 8, Deuteronomy, "And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." You know, this is what he was looking for here, was the appropriate response on their part, the response to the trials and difficulties of the wilderness. It says in verse 3, "So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." So God put them through this ordeal, and it was difficult. It was difficult for them. He put them through this test, this trial, in order to humble them, in order to teach them this vital lesson. You see, he was looking for the appropriate response. And the response was, or what it should have been, they were to learn that man relies on God and not merely on bread. Put your trust in God, not on what you can produce, what you can earn, what you are on the riches of this world. He says that your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. It's talking about Israel as a whole, Israel as a nation. Meaning God supplied their need. God supplied their need. He didn't give them abundance during the wilderness sojourning. He didn't give them beautiful homes. They dwelt in tents. But he did supply their needs. And it goes on to say, "You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you." Very simple lesson. We all understand that, don't we? Most of us have endured chastening. Some of us chasten our children. I don't think that's very popular anymore these days, but in any case, you understand the intent here. God chastens those that he loves. "Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him." Now drop on down to verse 11. Says, "Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today, lest when you have eaten and are full." Now think about this. God has promised, "Obey me, keep my commandments, and I will give you these blessings." Now then, what do you do with these blessings once you have them? Well, read on. It says, "When you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold are multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good in the end. Then you say in your heart, 'My power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth.'" You see, that's the risk. That's the risk. When you become wealthy, when God makes you wealthy, or when he makes a nation, this applies to nations or individuals either. When God gives wealth, there's a risk associated with it. People tend to say, "You see what I have done with my intellect, with my power, with my strength." Notice what he says. "And you shall remember the Lord your God," there's verse 18, "for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day." So you see, there's a problem here. You see, God is talking about responses, how people respond in different situations. Our spiritual condition is related not only to how we respond to trials and sufferings and hardships as the children of Israel in the wilderness, but also how we respond to success and good fortune and wealth. You know, sometimes we think, well, if God is going to test me, if he's going to mold within me the character that I need, that he wants me to have, if he's going to make me into the person he wants me to be, then I know he's going to bring some trials on me. Or he's going to permit those things to come on me. And we know that indeed these things happen. They happen to all of us to a later, greater or lesser degree. We know that there are many who have suffered and died for their faith. But you know, is it possible? I say it is possible, not only possible, it does happen, that the very thing you might need is wealth. I hope that's my problem. He needs to try me by giving me great wealth so that I can, you know, see if I pass with flying colors. I think most of us hope that's the problem, but sometimes God can test it. He can use that situation. He can use any circumstances, not only poverty and suffering and trials and difficulties, but also he can use wealth and success and all the good things of life to test us and to try us and to form us and mold us and make us into the type of people he wants us to be. And such could have been the case with ancient Israel. They could have been the people that God wanted them to be. They could have appreciated the wealth that God gave them. They could have understood and it could have been embedded within their minds and their hearts, this truth that it is God who gives the power to gain wealth. You know, even if we use our own strength and we're very smart business people or whatever, we use our wisdom and use whatever resources we have available to us and make the best out of them and gain a great deal of wealth that way. You know, that's good. That's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Some people are prejudiced against wealthy people. We shouldn't be. Wealth is a good thing because ultimately it flows from God. But you see, that's just the point. It does come from the abilities that God gives. And to the wealthy, that person must realize that that's the origin of wealth. God is the origin of wealth. He owns everything. And any ability you have, any ability that I have, it comes from God one way or the other, whether we say it's natural or whether say it was, you know, directly given as a special gift. Either way, it doesn't matter. It's still a gift from God, and he is the one who gives power to get wealth. So there are different responses to different situations in life. The content of the heart is revealed through how we respond to life circumstances. You know, have you ever been in a situation, or have you ever heard of a situation, and you heard how people responded to it? You said, not me. If I'd have been there, this is what I would have done. You know, you ever watch anybody in an automobile, say on television, you're watching how they're in traffic, and they're responding to all the other bad drivers? You think, not me. It'd be a breeze for me. I could just drive right on through there, and it wouldn't bother me at all if you get out there and try it. And you see that you're just like them, maybe even worse. Sometimes you might look at somebody else and say, boy, if I'd ever gone through that situation, here's how I would have handled it, and it wouldn't have bothered me at all. Then you find yourself in that situation, and you think back about that, and you think, you know, that person I was criticizing, where'd he get all that patience? He dealt with it great, you know. He did well with it. That's the way life is. But the point is, the content of the heart is revealed through how we respond to life circumstances. Now, God already knows the content of our hearts, but sometimes we don't know the content of our hearts. So it takes these circumstances to bring them out. You see this happening again and again in ancient Israel. You see it happening in the life of David. Sometimes it takes an act of God, or it takes a particular set of circumstances. These things come, whether by direct acts of God or by things he permits to happen over the natural course of history. These things will happen, and they will bring out the content of people's hearts. And hopefully we'll be able to see them when they come out. Other people do, by the way. Other people can see them pretty clearly. But we need to be able to see them ourselves. Because our spiritual condition, as I said, is related not only to how we respond to trials and difficulties and hardships, but also how we respond to everything else in life, all other circumstances and conditions, including good fortune and wealth and success and all the things we think of as the good things of life. How we respond to those things will bring out the content of our hearts. Now, we see some examples in Scripture of this very thing. For example, over in the book of Job, in Job chapter 2, we know the story of Job, of how God permits Satan, he permitted Satan to bring devastation to his home. He lost a great deal. Finally God let him strike Job himself with sickness. And so we read about how, well, it says in verse 7, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job, this is chapter 2, verse 7, with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And so you can imagine painful boils. If you ever had just one or two boils, and you know they're painful ones, you know that if you were covered with them, what kind of miserable existence that would be. And here Job was covered with these things. It says, and he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Now, probably this was these are the words of a desperate woman. She's desperate because she sees the horrible pain of her husband, what he's having to endure. And he's saying, look, you know, she sees it. She doesn't know, obviously, that Satan is not permitted to take his life. So she says, why don't you just go ahead and curse God and be done with it? Be out of your misery then, as it were. But I want you to notice there are two responses here. There's her response, curse God and die. But notice his response, verse 10. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? We're there ready to accept the wealth he sends to us, the goodness he sends to us. What about the bad things he sends to us, whether directly or by his permissive will? What about that? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So he continued to say, blessed be the name of the Lord. So you have these different responses here. You have the response of Job, who continues faithfully serving God, even though he's lost his wealth and now appears he's lost his health. And then you have the response of others, including his wife, says, curse God and die. Responses, how we respond to circumstances, says a whole lot about the content of our hearts. We also could go back through many other examples in Scripture. For example, you know, it was the same grace that touched the life of Pharaoh and the Egyptians that also touched the people of Israel. When God acted in Egypt, when he brought down the plagues so as to show that he in fact was God, the God of the Hebrews was the true God, and to convince Pharaoh to let the people go, you know, what Pharaoh saw was the same thing the Israelites saw. The act of God. The work of God. Yet it had one effect on Pharaoh, another effect on other people, didn't it? In fact, many of the Egyptians said, look, their God is God. Let them go. Pharaoh hardened his heart. When it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, you know what that means really is that God, in his acting in history, in effect, hardened the heart of Pharaoh. But he didn't reach down there and turn something and make an otherwise good man into a hardened man. No. Pharaoh hardened his own heart. It was his own hardness that was brought out when God acted. And the same can be said of the children of Israel once they were in the wilderness. Here they were, ready to go, and they went. There must have been at least some wavering faith, to say the least, because they did go. They left. Then they got out in the wilderness, having experienced the grace of God, having experienced the power of God, and having seen his actions in history in bringing them to this point. And what do? Well, you brought us out here to die. They hardened themselves. So you could say, in effect, God hardened their hearts. He did it by bringing them there. But it was their own hardness that came out, was the response of God's having brought them there. So we see how that all these different circumstances we can face in life, They bring out a response. And sometimes they reveal to us the contents of our hearts that we don't even know is there. That's why it's important that we go through so many different things. That's why it's important that God set up a world where it runs the gamut from extreme poverty to extreme wealth, from extremely good fortune to extreme misfortune. It runs the gamut. And in all of the mix of all of this, especially the elect, those that God is working with, those God deals with, those who, in whom dwells the Spirit of God, especially they are molded and shaped by all of this. With this in mind, go over with me to Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, because this is all this information, I believe, is right here in the backdrop of what Jesus says in Matthew 13. It says, beginning in verse 1, it says, "On the same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea, and great multitudes were gathered together to him, so that he got into a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. When he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, Behold, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on the stony places, where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up, because they did not have depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears, let him hear." Notice, he who has ears, in other words, spiritual ears, if you meaning understanding, then let him understand this. Let him comprehend it. Then in verse 10, it says, "And the disciples came and said to him, Why do you speak to them in parables? He answered and said to them, Because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given." Now, why had it not been given to them? There may be a number of answers to that question, but I think one of them comes out right here in the text. "For whoever has, to him will be given, and he who has will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him." Well, he just has said, "And whoever has ears to hear, let him hear." Now, if you don't have this ability to comprehend for whatever reason, then you're not going to comprehend. And the more comprehension you have, the more you're able to discern these things, well, the more responsibility goes with it. Verse 13, "Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says..." Now he quotes from Isaiah, and notice how in Isaiah's prophecy we're told why they don't see and why they don't hear. And this is speaking in generalities. It's not talking about infants. It's not talking about people who are mentally defective in such a way that they can't understand. It's talking about normal, ordinary people who hear and should be able to understand. But notice he says, "Hearing you will hear and shall not understand, and seeing you shall see and not perceive." Why? "For the hearts of this people have grown dull." There's their problem. That's their problem in understanding. That's why they don't see, why they don't hear. It's because their hearts have grown dull. Their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed. So you see, he's talking about a response. The disciples responded to his parables by saying, "Tell us, what do these things mean? We want to know." Other people respond by simply closing their ears. They don't want to know. He's talking about responses here. "Lest," meaning otherwise, "they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears." In other words, if they change that condition that they've adopted for themselves, if they change it, if they open their eyes, if they open with their ears, then they see and they hear. It says, "Lest they should understand with their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them." So what he's saying is the reason they don't hear, they don't understand, is because they've blinded themselves and closed their ears. Their hearts have grown dull of hearing. But he says, verse 16, but blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. In other words, they're responsive. And he's talking about responses to the same word. People who hear the same word respond differently based upon the content of their hearts. A very simple concept. For surely I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. In other words, they saw it in types and shadows and symbols and visions. They looked forward to the day of Christ coming and to the redemption he would bring, but they didn't see what we're able to see now as we look back at that time at Christ. And of course, as we will do so continuously until we take the bread and wine. We don't stop doing it at that point, but that becomes a kind of a focal point for us. And then he says in verse 18, therefore, hear the parable of the sower. When someone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who received seeds by the wayside. So he receives it, but it doesn't last. Why? Well, the wicked one snatches it away, says he does not understand it. There are many reasons, as I said, for not understanding. One reason is simply that you're dull of hearing. You've closed your eyes and your ears. Verse 20, but he who received the seed on stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. This is a different response. Different response, but notice what happens. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For then tribulation or persecution arises because of the word. Immediately he stumbles. In other words, this is his response to trials and tribulations and the difficulties of life. This is the way he responds. What he received, the word he received that brought joy, goes by the wayside. Now there's another response here. Now he who receives seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. This is his response to wealth. He allows the deceitfulness of riches to choke the word. It didn't have to be. The problem is not riches. The problem is with his response to it. Verse 23, but he who receives the seed on the good ground is he who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and produces some 100-fold and some 60 and some 30. So this is the one who responds differently from all the above. So it's all about responses. And as I said earlier, how we respond to the various conditions that we run into, the various circumstances that we encounter in life, reveals an enormous amount about the content of our hearts. But you know, the good news is, and I would have to take issue with the Augustinians and the Calvinists on this point, is that we have some control over the content of our hearts. Some say, well, we're all so desperately wicked and corrupt, and we are. But some say that we're so totally depraved that we can't really do anything until God completely changes us by his grace. Well, the point is, grace is there. Grace is ready, accessible to change us, to give us whatever we need to change. The point is, we do have something to say about the content of our hearts. And when we look at our lives and we see that our responses to the conditions that we have encountered, the circumstances we have encountered in life, have not been adequate, have not been appropriate, then we can acquire a new heart through God's help. It's simply a matter of relying on him to help us make those changes and to write within us his law. That's the content of the new covenant, isn't it? I will write my laws on their hearts. And it's talking about the individuals, not just merely the nation at this point. But I will write my laws in their hearts, in their inward parts. And in that way, we will know God in a way. And God will enable us to make the changes that are necessary, not only the outward changes, not only the things as we relate to other people to look good on the outside, but to change the very core of our beings so that what we the way we respond is appropriate, for it comes from a heart of obedience.